Welcome to the Should Have Bet More podcast presented by VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. Coming up on the show, Ian Eagle of CBS will be calling the Final Four, called the iconic UConn-Duke game the other day. We'll still get some reaction from that, look ahead to the Final Four, and here we are a couple days later. Finally started to get to the point where it sinks in and you just start to think about something else. I mean, that game was so dramatic the other day. I'll get to some baseball thoughts in a minute. That game was so dramatic and just so shocking the way it ended that it consumes you. Just every couple of hours or so, every half hour, every hour, you think, man, that actually happened. I can't believe what I just saw. I can't believe what that actually is, how the game ended. You just have that in a little bit of a cycle for a day or two, and recording this on a Tuesday before the baseball games have begun. No day games here on Tuesday, which annoys me. Put some games on during the day. But, you just go through these cycles where it's just, man, it's all you think about for a little while, and it just keeps popping up like, wow, what an ending. And, looking back at this, a couple things I wanted to mention, a couple things I wanted to react to. And it's getting a lot of attention. I didn't see it at the moment. Talk to Ian Eagle about it coming up, seeing if he saw it. The Hurley head bump with the ref. I mean, people would say, oh, they went out with their friends. And obviously, it's different because it's not in a moment of confrontation. So there's a much different context, too. Because if it wasn't in any sort of confrontation, if it's in any different moment other than, hey, my guy just hit a game-winning three, essentially a game-winning three, there's still 0.3 or 0.4 on the clock. That's got to be a technical, but I don't want it called there. It shouldn't have been called there. In the context of it, makes it where it's you let it go. But for a head coach to go up to a ref and just go forehead to forehead like that, if nothing else, is extremely, extremely bizarre. I couldn't believe Hurley, and I know he knows the ref, he's close to the ref, all that. None of that changes the fact that was just an odd encounter. I know he's trying to hear him, and Hurley's an odd, quirky guy to begin with. But boy, that was a strange interaction. It was harmless. Again, there's no not confrontational or anything like that. I get it, and that matters, and that's why you're not going to give him a technical there. But I don't. And UConn fans get very defensive of, oh, you're making something out of nothing. You're exaggerating. That's not making something out of nothing. That was to say that was bizarre, I think, is a very fair statement. And just going back and watch the game, or at least chunks of it, the other night, rewatched a lot of it. I think a couple key things. Foster, who was huge against St. John's for them on Friday, really had nothing on Sunday. And sometimes these athletes, adrenaline can take over when you're hurt, you're sick, whatever it is. Adrenaline can take over for a game, but it's that second game a couple days later where you're just in pain, you're sore, you can't get up the second time. And Foster did nothing, didn't score, wasn't a factor. So he was great against St. John's, really defied expectations, defied the nature of that injury. Had foot surgery just 19, 20 days before the game. And most people thought he's not going to play. If he plays, he's not going to be effective. He was very effective on Friday. Probably the difference between Duke advancing and St. John's advancing. Then on Sunday, he had nothing. And going back, and this is what happens with these miraculous comebacks, these great comebacks. Starts very innocently. In baseball, you're down 6 or 7 runs. The walk, the infield single, the little blooper. In football, sometimes you down the punt at the one instead of, again, a touchback. It's just these little moments you don't really think of in the moment, and then you go back, and it becomes huge thinking about it. And to me, that was UConn cutting it to 15 at the half on Sunday, because that could have very easily, I think it was 40-21. That could have easily, if that continued, that run continued, that's 22-24. If it's 22-24, it's just UConn's not getting off the mat. It's just too many points to make up. That game is going to be over, and who knows where it goes from there. The fact that it was 15, yeah, it's still a big deficit, but 15 is not 20. It's not 25. 15 is manageable. It's manageable. It's still hard. It's still asking a lot, but it's manageable. And UConn getting it to 15 was one of those little mini victories, and they just had these little mini victories along the way where, all right, it's 7 or 9. And then, all right, it's down to 5. And they just kept chipping away, similar to a baseball team that just kept, all right, little run here, base hit here, just kept putting runners on base, just kept chipping away runs. And before you know it, they get the miracle ending, the miracle shot. It was a great call by Ian Eagle. Some of the videos were great, too, of Raftery and Grant Hill just in stunned silence. I'll ask Ian here too coming up if that affected his call. Did that throw him off? Was he okay with the silence? Because I've seen the shot, as I'm sure most of you have seen the shot, heard of the shot, the call. Probably, it's hard to count. I would easily say, I mean, it's way more than like 50. It's probably 100 seems like a lot, but it's probably between 50 and 100 times, which is crazy. You just think you watch one shot, a little 10-second sequence, 100 times. But if it's not 100, it's pretty close to 100 times, just rewatching it. And amazing ending. As far from a betting standpoint, we're still at Illinois minus 2 against UConn. I'm surprised. And then the other one, Michigan minus 1.5 against Arizona. Good luck. I mean, I'll have some thoughts on that game. I got to look into it a little bit more on Friday. My initial thoughts, though, are just good luck picking a winner there. I went with Arizona before the tournament. I see no reason to jump off it. Little thicker, a little better inside. Michigan's probably got more in terms of their skill guys, in terms of the shot making, but boy, you're talking about inches instead. Not these teams aren't separated by feet or yards or miles. This is separated by inches, millimeters. If they play 10 times, it's probably 5 apiece. I mean, these teams are that good, that evenly matched. I'm surprised Illinois is still 2 over UConn. I know Illinois played better. UConn has certainly been up and down. And maybe you're just falling into the recency bias of that miraculous UConn win, but there is a little bit of, and there is a little bit of the Kansas City Chiefs with UConn, where you're just like, man, do I really want to bet against Mahomes? Do I really want to bet against Hurley? And that can be dangerous because that could be just living off past teams and things that are not related to this game and this matchup. And, you know, it didn't work out a couple years ago, Chiefs in the Super Bowl, where you just keep going to the well with Mahomes. Eventually that well runs dry. But boy, UConn beat Illinois already. I know it's a different team. Wagler didn't play much, didn't shoot much, only had a few attempts. Different team, but I don't know how you're laying points to this UConn team. From a futures perspective, if you have UConn, they were 15-1 before the year, and it's kind of amazing. You got them 15-1, you bet it thinking, and I've talked about that bet several times throughout the year. You think you get to a Final Four. A couple years ago, you get to a Final Four, and you're getting points the other way. You can hedge. You can middle. You're in great shape. This time, you're 15-1. You're happy to have the ticket, but there's not – and I've gotten a bunch of, you know, questions on Twitter and the shows I go on, people asking about hedging. And that's always personal. You know, how much did you bet? How do you feel about it? How much do you need money? All of those things factor in. It's not great from a hedging perspective. It's almost a little like if you took a shot on Miami to win the college football playoff at some of the bigger numbers, it's like, all right, I'm a 2-point dog in the semifinal, so I can make a bet there. But then if I get to the final, I'm going to be like a 5-6-point dog there, and I'm going to be laying, what, 220, 240 on a money line. So you don't – I understand wanting to earn some profit off the ticket, but you don't want to just give away all of your winnings either. And it's almost feels like you're hedging too early. So I be inclined to just ride it out. I know it's frustrating to get this far and come away with nothing and to come away losing money on a bet that, you know, you had before the year. Now you're in the Final Four. You're 2 wins away. You want to monetize it somehow, but it's just not that easy considering the odds. And you figured when you made that bet, you'd be in better shape here. Hey, I get to a Final Four. I'll be the favorite. I'll be, you know, this is UConn. They're going to be on equal footing with whoever they're with, or they're going to be favorites. Just not the case in this situation. Very, very strange in terms of that, or very hard to predict, unpredictable that they would be such a dog once they got to the Final Four. I mean, you could still get them plus 650. I was looking at most outstanding player odds. Lindenborg is the short shot 2-1. Barry's plus 325. Bradley plus 525. Those are both Arizona guys. Wagler plus 650. And then Reed is 10-1. Copete's 12-1. I was thinking Mullins with that shot, can he use that, propel that shot into some, like, hey, he's got 30 in the semis, 30 in the finals, and he wins. I guess that's possible. He's 25-1, but if you look at the game logs, 12 points, 17 points, 8 points, and 10 points, and 3-point shooting, 1 of 5 the other day, so he was 0 for 4 until he made that 3, was 0 of 8 in the first round, 2 of 6, and then 2 of 5. So he is on the tournament, just not shooting it very well here. You know, 5 of 24. Can he erase that with a couple big performances? Yes, I wouldn't say it's impossible. And I was thinking about it 25-1. But I think the bet, out of all these guys, the value, if you're looking for something, just coming into this blind, if you wanted a bet to make, I'd probably go with Terrace Reed at 10-1 for most outstanding player. 31-27 in the first game against Furman, then 10-13, 20-5, 26-9 against Duke. And yeah, Mullins hit the shot. If it weren't for Reed on Sunday, they lose that game by 25, 30 points. Reed really kept them in it, did a good job against Boozer, had four block shots. He's got nine block shots for the tournament. UConn's plus 600 or so here to win the title. Again, I can't see these in Connecticut, so I got to go offshore and look. But instead of the 6-1, I would feel pretty confident. If you told me right now, hey, UConn somehow, they're holding up the trophy Monday night. Also thought about Carabin, but Carabin hasn't had a great tournament. I'd feel pretty safe. I do think, you know, maybe, if you have nothing, if you have no bets, if you already have UConn, doubling down with Reed here, maybe not the best in terms of like the money management and the risk and things like that. But, I mean, look at the tournament Reed has had. Reed has 54 rebounds through four games in this tournament, you know, including a 31-27 in all the blocks. Reed at 10-1, most outstanding player, not a bad bet. I like UConn. I like Arizona, but how could you like them too much here? It's Michigan's really good. Those are absolutely dead even teams, in my opinion. But I will say we get a rematch here, UConn and Arizona. A rematch from November, a game Arizona won by 4. There was no Reed. There was no Mullins. So we'll see here, and we'll spend a little more time on this Friday, I would imagine. But right now, to me, it is UConn, Arizona in the final. Would not be shocked at all if it's the other two, Michigan, Illinois. And keep this in mind. Indianapolis, it's Big Ten country. Maybe you have a little slight home court advantage. In Indianapolis, that's certainly possible. Before we get to Ian, quickly on the baseball, no huge takeaways from the first 4 days. I guess the first few days, and I've talked about this, I think, on this show and a couple times, I think, with Gil on a numbers game before the season, just talking about baseball, saying, you know what, I've been watching a lot of spring training. I don't know if people are fully prepared for this ABS. This is going to be a game changer. It has. It's certainly a shock to the system to a lot of people. I think it's great, too. And part of me does feel bad for the umpires because these guys throw so hard with such movement, and these pitches either clip the strike zone or miss the strike zone by these fractions of inches. It's very hard to sit here and say, oh, that was, you know, that's a terrible call. How could you see that? Some of our terrible. C.B. Buckner is just an embarrassment. So part of me feels bad for the umps, but this is great in terms of the game. Not only are you getting the call right, it seems like the fans in the stadium, the in-stadium spectators, really get a kick out of the drama of it. Oh, there's a challenge. Is it good? Is it not good? And then they get to ride the ump and kind of, you know, Not harass the ump, but it starts to become a thing when they miss three calls and four calls. The guy in the Yankee game Monday night missed five in the first few innings. And that drama builds. There's a little bit of entertainment value with that. You're finally getting the calls right. And once we get to the system, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to think all these years. There was just no recourse. These umps were basically, they got to play God. If they said it was a ball and it's right down the middle, it's a ball. If it's a foot outside, they call it a strike. It's a foot outside, and there was no recourse for it. And, you know, is it better? You're just stuck with these bad calls and all of the implications that come with that. So I love it. I think it's been great. I think it's been fun, and it's really been the star of the first few weeks. You know, the games, nobody's really threw a few games here again, recording this before the games on Tuesday. The A's 0-4, that was a team a lot of people thought would be fun and would be good on offense, and maybe they could compete for a playoff spot, and maybe they turn around and have a good year, but they're 0-4, bad start for them. Nothing to the positive that's really shocking. I mean, I guess Washington being 3-1 is a surprise. Nobody's undefeated. Dodgers finally lost a game. Yankees finally lost a game. No huge takeaways. Nothing where I feel completely different about any of these teams than I did, you know, Thursday when the season opened, or Wednesday before the season opened. Burns threw a good game for the Reds on Monday night. You know, Taiwan Walker, why he's still pitching for the Phillies, I have no idea. That's a hole in the rotation. He got bombed. Colorado finally got a win. First win for them, first loss for Toronto. McClanahan making his return on Tuesday night. Mets are going to be good. Mets, you know, 3-1 start here. They're going to hit. That's a good team. Bichette off to a slow start. That happens sometimes with guys coming to New York. Boston 1-3. But again, no major takeaways. The big takeaway is ABS and just how different it's making baseball. These umps have to just hate it, because for years, especially if you're one of these longtime umps, whatever I say goes. If I say it's a strike, it's a strike. If I say it's a ball, it's a ball. Now every single move you make, every single call you make gets micromanaged and picked apart and put on trial time after time, and you could tell they just get so annoyed when these hitters tap their head. And I like it though; it's good for the game. I think most people like it and seem to enjoy it. So we'll do more baseball here as the weeks go on, as start to get closer and closer. NBA playoffs, and I do think NBA will have a good postseason. If you get a Spurs Thunder, that's the one I think most people want to see. Wembanyama, there's a little rivalry there between him and Holmgren. They're both young. There's some nastiness there. Spurs beat them in the regular season. Both are probably the two best teams, probably the two best players in the league. I'd still put Jokic probably ahead of SGA, but two of the three best players. Luka's got something to say about that, but you get the idea. Two of the best players in basketball with SGA and Wemby. You got a little nastiness, a genuine rivalry brewing. They're both young. They're good, both going to be going at it for years to come. That's the series I hope we get. I think most people hope we get, and it should be a good postseason. East is pretty well balanced. Could be some upsets. It's not like there's some dominant teams at the top. The teams at the bottom aren't that bad. West is pretty good. So we'll do more baseball. We'll do NBA playoffs here as we start to finish up college basketball. But coming up next, it will be more college basketball. Ian Eagle, the voice of the Final Four, joins us. That is next. This should have been more. All right, we are back. You can catch him CBS, TNT, Yes Network, where he'll be calling the Final Four this weekend for CBS, and he joins us now. It is the great Ian Eagle. Ian, well, boy, what a couple of days it's been. Have you caught your breath yet?
I have officially caught my breath, but I'll be the first to admit that I did not sleep well Sunday night, and that just shows you how an effect of a game can do things to you that you don't even anticipate. I didn't play in the game. I didn't coach in the game. I had no skin in the game. I had no rooting interest in the game. Yet my mind was still racing after UConn, Duke, and that's what's super about sports. It's the fact that it can impact you on an emotional level that you're not even familiar with until you're actually in the thick of it. And that's why we keep coming back. Live sports rules, and there's no script.
You did not play in the game. That would have been a hell of a story if you had played in the game. That would really have been interesting.
Eligibility, I would have to check. There might be a smidge remaining.
All right, we'll get to the Final Four, but we got to go through a few things from the ending of that game. You get the steal. The ball goes from Mullins to Kerriman back to Mullins. As he's shooting it from where you are, can you tell out of his hands this is good? Can you tell out of his hands this has a shot? What's going through your head as he's releasing that ball, and boy, it got nothing but net?
Well, I think what I've experienced in those kinds of moments where it's very frantic and time is of the essence, you get some players that don't fully square and don't get into their actual shot release. They just do a fling towards the rim, and odds are a fling towards the rim is not going in. But in the moment, I did feel like he got into a really good place. And it looked like a jump shot for him. It looked like the shot he would take normally from three-point territory. Obviously, it was lifted. It was from logo land. But he got great lift on the delivery. And he snapped his fingers right. His mechanics are beautiful, just to begin with. And then as the ball hits flight, look, as a play-by-play announcer, you're going through all the possibilities. One of the possibilities is that the ball's going in. But most of the time, it is not. It's hitting the rim, so now you have to be ready. Is it rimming up? Is there a chance it rolls in? In this particular case, well, I don't know in my career, and I've done thousands of basketball games, I don't know if I can remember a shot that went more purely through the net than this shot that made the perfect sound. It didn't touch anything else. So it looked pretty coming off the fingertips. Obviously, it's going to go down as one of the great shots in March Madness history.
And people are going to hear your call forever, and you crushed the call, which everyone would expect.
Thanks, buddy.
But I would imagine, you know, looking back, you're probably, I don't know, are you happy with your call? Is it one of those things where if you had more time to think about it, you'd be more nervous? Is it just so spur of the moment? And going back, Raftery and Grant Hill are stunned silent. Did that throw you off a little bit? Because you jump back in with the march means drama. It was great. Did that throw you off their silence? Just kind of take me through the call.
Yeah, so the first part of it, I've done this way too long to get upset or to think what I should have said or could have said. I've just done too many of these games. I think the biggest key for me is to be factually correct. So make sure you've got all the players that are involved accurately. And then do you convey the emotion of the moment? And then don't jump the gun on what could be. You know, I think as a play-by-play announcer, we all want that sensation of what we dreamed of as a kid in the driveway. 3-2-1, it's good. But 1-0 is not as simple as you think it might be. So I have learned through the years to wait, to show a little patience. And you're talking about a fraction of a second to make sure that you're right, that you don't say that this is for the Final Four, because it's not. They still had a chance to inbound it. There was still time remaining. Well, what has changed through the years, and it happened in the NBA, college as well, the officials are allowed to check it after the fact. And I think what ended up happening for a lot of play-by-play announcers, the initial calls that we always used to make were now, there was an adjustment based on, we'll see if it counts. They're going to check the clock. In this particular case, I was very happy and pleased that I didn't just blurt out for the win. And ultimately, there was a whole other secondary call of Duke triggering the ball inbound, UConn tapping it away with Caravan, and then the Huskies claim their spot in the Final Four. As far as Raf and Grant, I think the goal in these moments is to mirror what somebody is feeling watching the game. Ultimately, that's how you try to approach it, and you do it in a professional way, and you try to have command in the moment. That was literal shock from both Bill and Grant, who have been around basketball their entire lives. And I think that also tells the story of the moment. As far as timing, I allowed Grant and Bill to jump in. It was Bill who did jump in with one comment. And then I sensed that I should probably jump in again with something to put a period on it. And that's what came out of my mouth in the moment.
Yeah, Raftery says impossible. And then
utterly impossible.
And then I think he gave the nylon, the onions. I've seen, how many times have you watched the shot, watched the sequence?
I've probably seen it now 100 times because whatever social media feed that I'm on, it just keeps popping up. And, you know, it's funny when it starts playing on a loop because it starts to get ingrained in your brain. I'm not one that watches back all of my games the second that they're over. You know, I tend to just turn the page. And yeah, I'll catch highlights, and certainly if there was a sequence that I wanted to go back and watch to see how we handled it, I'll do that even in my everyday broadcast life. There was no avoiding it. In addition, I think where we are with social media and how people communicate with one another, I can't tell you how many people sent it to me, whether it was the video of the game-winning shot or the video of Raf and Grant. You know, I've gotten hundreds of messages from people attaching it. I think because people want to feel connected, obviously, in society in general. But then when you have a sports moment that stands out like this, it brings even more of that sense of community. And, you know, ultimately that's still something that sports can do that very few things can do. And that is bring people together in a way that you can never predict or never fully anticipate.
before we get to the Final Four, I didn't see it till the next day. I'm sure you've seen it by now. Hurley, like, nose-to-nose with the ref, man. Not that I want a technical call, and a lot of people don't, but it was bizarre. Do you understand what happened? Did you see that live? What was kind of your take on that whole thing? Because it really was strange. If not,
yeah, I didn't see it live, but this would be my take on it. Roger Ayers is the official that we're talking about. Highly respected, excellent communicator, someone who explains things very well. His bedside manner is through the roof impressive in how he relates to coaches and players and how he handles himself. So I think we sometimes lose the human aspect of this. That was not Dan Hurley going at an official. His team just took the lead. That was Dan Hurley getting caught up in the moment with someone that he actually has a positive dynamic with. They locked eyes. I'm not sure if he thought that Ayers was coming over to say something to him or their two orbits just met in the moment. And he did that, in my opinion, watching it over and over and knowing the personalities of the two involved. He did that with no derision whatsoever. So I know the reaction has been, you got to tee him up. That's unacceptable in our game. You also have to take into the personal relationship and the human dynamic of the moment. And I don't think Roger Ayers for a second thought that Dan Hurley was challenging him or looking for something other than they shared a very interesting and unique connection on the back end of a historic shot.
Yeah, and if it's under confrontational circumstances, if it's really under any other circumstances, yeah, it's going to be technical. But
yep.
As strange as it was, that's obviously not going to happen in that spot. What is it like? Can you hear him when you're doing the games, or you're too busy like talking and worrying about the game? You can't hear Hurley.
Okay. I can't hear anybody. I can hear Raph, Grant, Tracy when her mic's on, and our producer and director. That's it. There is no other sound that makes its way into my headset, and I like it that way. I mean, that job requires complete concentration. Of course, you're aware of what's happening around you, and being courtside allows you to see things that others may not see. So you might catch something, and then there's a button on our console where you can talk to the producer, talk to the director, communicate in that manner that's not on the air, and that allows you to maybe get something that the producer didn't see or the director didn't see, but I saw, or vice versa, something they saw or someone in the tape room saw, and now they relay it to me and now we can present it. So no, I rarely hear coaches, players, officials, even fans. It's funny. I have a very vivid memory of the Nets and the Celtics in the conference finals. So we're going way back, 01-02. And local, at that point, we were allowed to do the first round and the second round. We're not allowed to do the conference finals. But at the time, MSG was the parent company. It was for Fox Sports New York, which was the former sports channel. They sent us on the road to Boston, Raph and I, to cover the event, to file reports during the off days. And then the second the game was over, we would do a post-game show. And Bill and I sat along the press area on the baseline. And I have a very vivid memory. No headset on. You're just watching the game like everybody else. I could not believe what I was hearing. I couldn't believe it. From fans, from players, from coaches, from staff. It was very eye-opening because I'm not a part of that when the headset is on. And it just shows you how many games I do, but how few events I now go to just as a normal fan.
Do you ever, and I'll get to the games in a second, do you ever, even though if you don't verbalize, you know, predictions, it's not your job and your role, do you ever mentally think, all right, this game is over, all right, this team's going to win? Does that seep in,
yeah,
or is it just, you know what, next play? It
does. No, you're human, and I've had to adjust my thought process on that. There's a very famous play that you will remember, of course, because you've got a steel trap of a brain. But it was the Miami Miracle, and it was the Dolphins and the Patriots. Oh. And Dan Fouts had a tight flight. And I remember him saying prior to the whole sequence, he's like, hey, the second this game's over, we got to dart out of here. And I said, yeah, no problem. It's the only time in my career I've taken my notes, all my charts, all my preparation work, and I put it in my bag before the final play because I thought it might save us 9 seconds to help Dan make his flight back to the West Coast. Meanwhile, that play, if you ever listen back to the highlight, I'm soft-shoeing it initially because I've seen so many of these laterals and busted plays, and it hits me at one point as Kenyon Drake is circling up the field, and I notice, obviously, that Gronkowski is on the field playing defense, and the line that I use because that's what hit me in the moment is Gronkowski doesn't have the angle, and I could see it, and he scores, and then absolute bedlam occurs. So, 2 points. From that point on, I've never taken my notes and put them in my bag. That's the first little bit of experience that you gain of, hey, don't do that. And the second one is Dan did not make his flight. We then stayed on. We had to do a post-game hit because it was such a thrilling game that now there was interest. And it's funny, though, those moments flash in front of you when you get to late in games of, hey, be thorough, be factual, just make sure you're on it. That is the goal, and that's how you just try to approach these things.
All right, these games, UConn played Illinois on Black Friday. They won. Different Illinois team. Wagler didn't really play. I mean, I don't know. What do you look at in terms of like a keys to a game? What do you expect here once the game starts 6:09 Saturday evening?
Yeah, I mean, that game, I'm not even sure I'll watch it back, to be perfectly honest. I think they're so different. I would rather watch the NCAA tournament games. Now, obviously, I've had UConn the last two games. I had Illinois the first two rounds of the tournament. So I've seen them both. I've seen them both play at their best moments. I don't know if I've seen UConn at its absolute best, but I've seen them in a pressure moment on the big stage. And Illinois just ravaged through the competition in Greenville. Penn was no match for them, and then VCU couldn't match up either. With that said, I think Illinois has got a lot of confidence in who they are, in the mix that they can bring, the fact that they can beat you on the inside, they can beat you on the outside. They have Wagler who can break you down. He can take over games and can do it in a manner that's not necessarily in your face. You know, he's one of those guys where you could watch the game and then look at the box score after and say, man, I didn't realize he had 23 points and 8 assists and 7 boards. He's that kind of guy. UConn is riding this wave right now. You know, I don't see this as a classic Huskies team, but they're resourceful, and certainly they have belief. Their head coach has gotten to a place where the buttons that he pushes are usually the right ones. He knows how to motivate his team. Illinois is very big. They are very physical. They, I think, now truly believe, that they can win the whole thing. I don't know if they really believe that prior to the NCAA tournament, coming off the Big Ten tournament. Right now, they do believe it.
The other game, boy, if they played 10 times, it'd probably be 5 each. I like the Arizona muscle and thickness maybe a little more underneath. Michigan, probably a few more shot makers. But other than that, good luck trying to, you know, predict this game or figure out who's going to win. Do you see any edge anywhere, or is this pretty much anyone's game with 3 minutes to go, and these teams are, you know, as good as each other for the most part?
Yeah, I'd say more of the latter. I just think there's a lot of NBA talent in this game, a lot of guys that you're going to see play eventually at the next level. And the only reason I point that out is to signify how much talent there is. Again, it's no knock on the other matchup. I just think the individual talent in this matchup is such that we're going to hear these names through the years once they get playing to the next level. Michigan, I've seen a lot of, saw them during the regular season quite a bit, saw them in the Big Ten tournament, very familiar with who they are, what they are. Lindeborg is an unbelievable story. What they have up front is real between Mara and Johnson. Cadeau is such a huge key for them. You know, the Kaysen injury, which they've overcome, is still something that troubles me. He was just a guy that when things weren't going perfectly, he could bail them out. And they don't necessarily have that. McKinney is, he's a pro. He will be a professional player. He just carries himself like an NBA player. Just watch his movements. Watch how he glides up and down the floor. He just looks like an NBA player. He may end up staying just because it gives him some time to physically develop and get a year of being a starter under his belt. And then on the Arizona side of things, Berries is really talented, and their backcourt is dynamic. And then they have size up front. Pete's an NBA player. There's no doubt about it. Cravos is someone who I think has had a huge impact this year. He's become a better defensive player. He's a better shot blocker than he was. Offensively, he's massive on the interior. So I just see this as one of those pick'em games. Foul trouble could play a huge role in this. And the intangibles of, all right, who handles the pressure of being in a national semifinal with a chance to move on and win a championship. That's the part you just don't know until the players are actually in that moment.
In the last minute here, Spurs Thunder collision course. Is that what everyone in the NBA circles is kind of hoping for, rooting for? But what a hell of a
yeah! You're shifting gears on me. I've obviously been out of the mix for a couple of weeks. I would think so. I just don't see anyone else in the West, barring major injuries, being able to play at that level. You know what? What OKC is, they're just so ridiculously well-oiled. They are a machine. They know how to win. No matter who's in the lineup, they win. It's an attitude. It's a mentality. And it shows. And it starts with Shea, of course. But everybody else follows. And then San Antonio, to be this good this quickly, to put the right mix of players around Wembanyama the way that they have, has been a stroke of genius. You know, Castle is one of the great two-way stars in the game right now. And they now are in a position where I think you've seen enough this season to say if they won the Western Conference, you can't now say, well, that would be a huge shock. It would not. They're that good. Mitch Johnson has done a fantastic job. That's not easy. Not easy to step in and replace Greg Popovich and maintain the right approach and touch for what this team requires.
Ian, you're the best man. Appreciate the time. I know you're busy. This is a great time of the year. Thanks for coming on.
Well, always a pleasure, bud. It's going to be a blast. Looking forward to it. Hopefully we get some memorable moments once again.
All right, rate, review, subscribe. Thanks to Ian Eagle. We will be back on Friday. See you then.